right, it's Dave Plyer here on 720 WGN. Welcome to our radio special, Legends of Rock. From the rhythm and blues roots from the 1940s and 50s, rock and roll proliferated in the 50s and 60s with bands and artists such as the Beatles, the Moody Blues, Jimi Hendrix, the Rolling Stones, the Who's, the Kinks, the Doors, among others. In a growing countercultural movement, rock played a major part in empowering and uniting the masses. When the 60s came, bands like Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, the Allman Brothers, Frank Zappa, and Eric Clapton began to surface and refine the standard set. Rock music in the 70s was a rebellious celebration and innovation. Progressive rock even became more prolific. What was rock and roll in the 60s became simply rock in the 70s. The blending of earlier music genres is what gave the 70s a vibrant ring to it. The true golden age of rock music, classic rock as we refer to today. Conversations with Stevie Van Zandt of Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, Robert Lamb of Chicago, Mick Jones of Foreigner, the incomparable Elvis Costello, Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick, and Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. First up, Chicago's Robert Lamb. He wrote many of the band's biggest hits, including Questions 67 and 68, Does Anybody Really Know What Time It Is?, Beginnings 25 or 6 to 4, and Saturday in the Park. They've released 5 number one albums and nearly 36 top 10 hits. And to talk about it all is Chicago founding member Robert Lamb. Robert, welcome in.
Thank you so much.
Well, Chicago has been around as long as I've been on the planet Earth, and I was born in 67, but I became a fan about a decade into your history and really rediscovering this amazing sound. Now, as a kid growing up in Brooklyn, you grew up with jazz playing in your home. You sang and played piano in the Brooklyn Heights Choir. You were 15 when you moved to Chicago, attended Chicago Vocational High School and Roosevelt University. What stayed with you all these years that influenced you about the city of Chicago?
My earliest memory is listening to the radio. Listening to the radio while I was going to high school, you know, getting up in the morning and, you know, getting ready to slog down the block over the icy sidewalks to wait for the bus to take me to school. But it's the radio stations in Chicago that struck me as very different than what I listened to in New York. And, of course, I was listening more to music as a teenager. But the variety of music that was and probably still is played on the radio stations in Chicago is varied. It's ethnically different. But there was a lot of jazz. There was a lot of R&B. And, of course, you know, the great top 40 stations at the time.
The WLSs, WCLRs, FYRs.
Yeah, and all of those had a big effect on not only me, but the rest of my co-founders of the band. It was just a very rich place to draw from. Of course, then when the Beatles came to be, that changed everything for anybody who was a musician at the time.
Well, you played and wrote music very early on, and people always ask an artist, who's your inspiration? It was Ray Charles for you.
It was Ray Charles for me. And again, you know, once the Beatles hit, the idea that a few guys in a little rock band could write their own songs and play them, that was a big awakening.
Now, at 23, you received a call to pursue your interest in forming a band. How did you come together with Walter, Terry, Danny, Lee, and James to form this rock and soul band that was first called The Big Thing?
I was playing with a couple of smaller bands around the North Side, mostly quartets, you know, guitar, piano, drums, bass. And I, just out of the blue, I received a telephone call one day, and I can't remember if it was Walt or Danny Serafin. It was one or the other. But it was explained to me the idea of putting together a rock band with horns, and was I interested? And they had heard that I played keyboards, and actually I later heard that they had come to listen to the bands I was playing with at the time, and so I was invited to come and meet them. And was I interested? And I was interested because, you know, it was just I was accustomed to listening to jazz, as you mentioned earlier, from my parents' record collection, and so the idea was fascinating to me.
So when they said horns, it was so unique and different to say horns with a rock and roll band, that right there must have been pretty appealing.
It was, and of course, you know, in R&B, you know, whether it was Wilson Pickett or Sam and Dave or whoever in that day, in R&B, the horns were present in many of the records, and then a couple of the Beatles songs, "Got to Get You Into My Life," particularly. There were horns present, so the Beatles were beginning to use horns, and so I thought this could be very interesting.
Now, you started touring around pretty quickly, and you were playing at clubs like Barnaby's in Chicago, where you also met the lead singer of a band called The Exceptions, and that was Peter, I believe.
Yeah, Peter. Peter. The Exceptions were the premier rock band, club band, in those days. Everybody who was a musician or in a band was very aware of them and just awed by the skills that band had in reproducing top 40 hits live on stage.
FM radio was just making a splash at the time, where Chicago's music was really embraced. But some stations at that time, did they know how to identify what your group was all about because it was such a new and unique sound?
No, I think that then and even now, I think several reasons, I think that Chicago has failed to fall easily into any particular pigeonhole, partly because we were trying to do something different, partly because the songs were coming from several members in the band with differing influences. So it was really sort of hard to categorize Chicago. And then, of course, recording the first several albums, all of them double albums, we sort of didn't know any better that you weren't supposed to do that. But we did have a champion in Jim Garcia, who was able to twist a few arms at Columbia Records. And luckily, Clive Davis, who was the head of Columbia Records, was willing to go along based upon success of the first album and the fact that we were really an accomplished performing band right from the get go.
Well, landed you in Billboard's top 20, so the proof was in the pudding right there. 148 weeks consecutively on the charts. I'd say that's pretty good right out of the box.
I wish we could do it again.
And I bet you can. Well, I'll tell you what, we're talking to Robert Lamb of Chicago, and we'll have more with him next on 720 WGN. Day Player on 720 WGN, and our radio special Legends of Rock continues with Chicago's Robert Lamb. Robert, what is your method to the madness of songwriting?
I have always tended to work sort of sporadically. And, of course, once Chicago started touring, I mean, even before the first album, I was not very good at composing on the road, although I was smart enough to write down ideas, whether they be lyrical or just a melody idea. I was smart enough to make some notes so that when I did get home and I did get to a piano, I had something to start with. But my method has been very slow. I'm not like an Elton John who can just sort of dash off a number of songs in a matter of days. I work slowly, and I rewrite and rewrite and edit and change things as I go, and that has always been the case. Of course, writing for Chicago was a very different matter. It wasn't just writing a song. It was a matter of writing a composition that would include places where the horns could play and the various soloists in the band could play.
But but months after the release of the first album, you went on to work on the second album. That's why I say it was nonstop. I mean, it was every 9 months. I mean, you were writing and writing, and while you were on tour, doing all of this at the same time. I mean, that's a lot of content to be throwing out there.
I think that when when you're young like that, and you know, you're wanting to seek approval, you're young and hungry, and lots of energy. I think that's appropriate. I mean, I'm glad that that's the way it happened.
Yeah. And just as iconic as of the sound of Chicago, Robert, the logo is so iconic, always dominant on all the covers. Who said, you know what? Because not a lot of bands, especially back then, had like a specific logo that was tied into their brand. You kind of made a brand for yourself with that logo. How did that all come together?
Oh, that was really sort of a philosophical decision that was very much influenced by Jim Guercio. And we talked a lot about a creative community. We talked a lot about this is the age of the hippie, and communes were happening where people would sort of step away from the mainstream of society and kind of work together and you know, have the focus be on whatever the project was. And in our case, it's music. And Guercio's point was that it seemed, at least in rock and roll, that whenever the focus went away from the music and was put upon particular individuals or anything other than music, it was a distraction. And he was right. To this day, in spite of all the fame and all the places that we've played and all the music that people are familiar with, you know, I can still pretty much travel anonymously, and it's really been a great freedom for all of us.
Yeah, I bet. Fast forward to the 80s, you moved down to Warner Brothers. David Foster took a hand in helping making the Chicago 16, co-writing 8 of the album's 10 songs, including Hard to Say I'm Sorry, which became a worldwide number one single when the album was released. The album went to the top 10, sold 1 million copies. The next was Chicago 17 and 84 with Stay the Night, Hard Habit to Break, You're the Inspiration, Along Comes a Woman. A whole new generation of fans at that time, just, you know, over a decade later, discovered what Chicago was all about.
I think that's true, and as a result of our continuing to tour around the world and playing, having the luxury of a large repertoire, as we played and performed, I think that audience that perhaps first discovered Chicago with Chicago 16 and 17 went back and looked through the catalog.
They did.
They went back and looked at their older siblings' vinyl collection.
I got to tell you, that's what I did. Because, I mean, I was born in 67, so I had to go back and do that. But I loved it. It was like, this is a pretty damn cool group, man. I mean, they've got a lot of history.
We still get comments like that all the time.
Chicago's very own Robert Lamb. For more on Chicago, visit ChicagoTheBand.com. All right, top stories are next on 720 WGN. Dave Player on 720 WGN, and our radio special, Legends of Rock, continues with Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Stevie Van Zandt. One of the greatest guitarists on the planet is the legendary Stevie Van Zandt. Stevie's career includes being a member of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, his band, The Disciples of Soul, and portraying Silvio Dante on The Sopranos. You and Bruce were friends like in the mid-60s. You met each other when you were both playing the circuit.
That's right. Yeah, I had my band, he had his. There weren't that many bands that got out of the garage. Everybody had a band in the garage the day after the Beatles played this variety show at Sullivan, I mentioned before. You know, like I've often said, February 8th, 1964, there was not one band in America. February 10th, the day after this show, everybody had a band in the garage. But only a few of them got out of the garage. And, you know, maybe there was a dozen bands in our area, and I had one and Bruce had one. So in those days, if you were in a band, you were friends.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And simple as that, because there's just so few of us. And Bruce was the only other guy I met in my life who was completely dedicated to it as I was, who didn't really have any interest in anything else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You got each other.
It was just like, you know, for a lot of people, it was a hobby. It was, you know, it was fun on the weekend, you know. But for us, it was a lifestyle right away. We knew that this was, you know, our destiny and our, you know, we were just misfits, you know, freaks, outcasts, and did not fit into society, and you know, couldn't see a way forward really for either one of us. You know, where were we going to end up until rock and roll came along and just kind of said, okay, you know, there's an option that I can understand. You know, that's something I can relate to because, you know.
Well, it speaks to your friendship.
Into sports. We weren't going into the military. We weren't going into our father's business.
Right.
You know, we weren't going to college. It was just like, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, it speaks to your friendship. You guys have been friends for over 50 years. I mean, it obviously speaks to your love for the music and for each other, too. And I don't know if people know this, but when they called Bruce the boss, you named him the boss. You did.
Well, you know, because I was a boss in my world and a very, very respected one. So when I started calling somebody else the boss, people really paid attention to that. Because, you know, they're like, wait a minute. You know, because I was equally popular, if you will, in my, you know, local area, you know, popular. So it was a surprise when I joined his band, you know, in order to, you know, contribute to his success. It was a surprise for most people. And so, you know, it was a bigger surprise when suddenly I said, you know, he is the boss. I'm declaring him the boss. And so when a boss calls somebody else the boss, you know, people pay attention.
People take notice. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You arranged the horns on 10th Avenue Freeze Out in 75, which kind of made you a permanent spot, on the E Street Band, dais and shortly thereafter. But for knowing each other for 10 years, this must have been a tremendous moment of bonding for you guys.
Well, yeah, we had been in each other's bands, you know, before that, you know.
Right.
So it was the final sort of configuration, you know. Okay, this is the one that has now. He managed to get a record deal. You know, he managed to get into the business, you know, which was a real mystery. You know, how do we get into the business? You know, how do we get into the music business? We had been in music locally for a long time, but how do we break into the business was a mystery and a miracle, and then he achieved it. And so, you know, suddenly, we were now going to go public. And, you know, all those years of development and playing live locally really paid off because we were very highly developed for a new band, you know.
Yeah.
By the time the public discovered us, we had been playing for 10 years.
Right, yeah. See, I think people, okay? I don't know if people get that. Yeah, you were, this was not like something that just kind of came about. You were, you know, first of all, you were part of the success of Born to Run. First big single that really put you guys on the map was Hungry Heart, which you co-produced, and you had so many successes along the way. You've been a consistent, trusted confidant longer than anyone else in the E Street Band. And I want to get to the story because it's one of my favorites that you've told before is The River. And you've spoken about this before. The River to Bruce was 20 songs. To you, it was 43 songs. The Ties That Bind is a favorite of mine. And it was originally intended to be on a different album. And then it became a part of this one.
Well, yeah, all of a sudden he became extraordinarily prolific. I mean, it was amazing. You know, and this is a bigger conversation, but I personally believe everyone has greatness in them, okay? No one's born great, which people have to understand. You know, nobody is born great. It's developed. And what happens is if you put enough time in and enough focus, I believe it taps into that greatness and suddenly, you know, the dam breaks, and that's what happened with Bruce. You know, the album before Darkness, you know, he wrote like 8.5 songs, and 8 of them were on that Born to Run album. You know,
and
he went from writing 8, you know, he went from writing 8.5 songs to 60 songs.
That's,
you know,
yeah.
You know, for Darkness, and then another 50 or 60 for The River. You know, so all of a sudden he went from, you know, saying, I mean, writing, you know, a handful of songs for an album to this enormous output.
Yeah.
of extremely high quality material, okay? And that comes from completely focused, you know, working on that development and craft. Work on it, think about nothing else for 10 years, for 15 years, you know, and suddenly, boom, you know, it cracks open, and that's what happened. And so there should have been at least another record from the Riveler, and we see at least one, and there should have been another record from the Darkness. Very happy they came out, finally. He did eventually release them
sure.
in the repackaged versions.
Right.
You know, I think it was called The Promise for Darkness.
Right. And, yep.
You know, and it ties it blind for the river, but you know, an entirely other album that should have come out in between. Whatever. As we, you know, I'm not going to dwell on why it didn't come out, but whatever. It, you know, they certainly are, you can hear the quality of that material. Is rather extraordinary and some of my favorite stuff.
Well, again, it speaks to your friendship.
As I said many times, every song a lost argument.
Yeah, right, right, exactly.
Because, you know, I mean, there are those songs people could have careers with, and he would just put them aside. So I'm glad they finally came out.
Yeah, same here. So are millions of others. Well, and then you also did, you know, 80s, 90s, and then reformed a couple of years ago, the Disciples of Soul. I mean, that was a big part of your world, especially last year.
Well, that was it. That was the biggest step for me was coming back to my own work, which I had unintentionally abandoned. You know, I started acting around that same time. The Sopranos came along and I started doing that, and then Bruce put the band back together in 1999, 2000, and between those two things, and then, you know, Sopranos turned into Lilyhammer, you know,
right.
I did 4 or 5 years on that.
Yeah.
You know, for Netflix, it was Netflix's first show. Before you know it, you know, 20 years went by.
Right.
And I kind of had just, you know, put aside my own solo stuff. And I went back to it, you know, 2 years ago and rediscovered it, really. And
sure.
Said, wow, this is a valuable, you know, part of my life. And I should revisit it and reconnect with it. And that's what I've been doing. The Soul Fire album was my reconnection to it.
Yeah.
Of course, I wasn't ready to write a new album after 20 years, so I basically covered myself. You know, I covered songs I'd written for other people.
And, which is cool, yeah.
And, you know. And so this new album I just did now was my first original material in over 20 years. So I'm really quite proud of it, and it's coming out in May.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And you mentioned The Sopranos, and this is what I always found fascinating, because when I found, because I'm an avid fan of The Sopranos. I think that is the best drama that has ever aired on television. I mean, the ensemble, the cast, the writing, everything was spectacular. But you weren't an actor. But the creator of the show, David Chase, he kind of relentlessly pursued you to audition for this.
Yeah, it's just part of David's, you know, rebelliousness, really. You know, he had been in TV a long time.
Yeah.
And he just kind of had, you know, it's hard to explain, but he was no longer interested in following the rules. Okay, let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, he had been a good soldier for so long that he was ready to make the move into movies, and he kind of saw this as a movie. You know, he kind of saw the pilot, you know,
yeah.
as a half a movie.
Right. Right.
He was half hoping that HBO would turn it down, actually,
really?
And so he could,
wow.
So he could like add a few scenes and make it into a movie
and be done. Yeah.
So he's breaking every single rule. You know, too many characters, the camera never moves, too many subplots, very complicated leading man. You know, and part of that rebelliousness was having me be in it.
I like that.
I've never acted before.
But I got that later. I got that rebelliousness later, that's one of the reasons he brought you into it. He wanted to shake it up. He didn't want the standard. You know, he wanted to have some fun with it and do something different. And the addition of you to the cast was fantastic. Did you first audition for the role of Tony?
Yeah, I did. He brought me down to play Tony, and it was very close. It was very close to actually doing that. And then Jimmy came along, and that was, you know, quite obvious that he should be Tony. But I went down at first as Tony, and then I said to David, I said, listen, you know, I'm starting to feel guilty about, you know, taking an actor's job here. You know, these guys, they work their whole lives, they go to class, they do off-Broadway, you know, and suddenly some rock and roll guitar player is coming along, you know, taking one of their jobs. I said, so he said, okay, well, in that case, I'll write you in a new part, that so you're not taking anybody's jobs, you know.
Interesting.
And so that's how we ended up.
Well, we're talking to Stevie Van Zandt from the E Street Band. There's more with him next on 720 WGN. Our radio special Legends of Rock continues with part two of my conversation with rock legend Stevie Van Zandt. Let's talk to us a little bit about your nonprofit effort to bring more music to schools, as there is never enough funding for the arts. It's called Teach Rock, which you founded with U2's Bono, Jackson Brown, Martin Scorsese, and your pal Bruce Springsteen.
Well, that's right. I mean, once the No Child Left Behind legislation went through over 10 years ago now, they just stopped all of the arts classes in the public schools, which is an absolute tragedy. And so to sort of keep the arts in the basic DNA of the education system, we figured let's go in the back door, let's go in the side door and do music history, because we're not going to be able to put instruments in kids' hands for a while. We'll have to find other ways to do that, and we have. But as far as the actual system, you know, the bureaucracy of the education system, you know, we figured it was easier to go the history route and focus more on middle school, you know. But we did make it adjustable. We made it adjustable for teachers to be able to adjust it to any grade level. We give them lots of tools. We're now up to 150 lessons online, and we do more every week. And, you know, just made sure that people get a chance to experience music. You know, we license all the music, we license all the videos, and teachers have found it to be very, very useful. And like you say, every kid's into music, thank God, because that's how we're basically allowing these teachers to find a way to common ground with this generation. This generation is different, man. You know, they're smarter than us, they're faster than us.
True.
And they have no patience.
No patience. They have a short mind span. They want it instantly.
That's right. And so this is the solution to that. Every teacher has trouble. You know, you talk to any teacher these days, what's the biggest problem? It's engaging the students and keeping them engaged, you know, because they're so used to looking at their device and getting instant whatever it is. You know, to actually teach somebody something, they have to be focused, and it takes time. And, man, that's been the biggest challenge for teachers. And so this is the solution, because as soon as you start talking about music, and by the way, we don't drag them to us. We go to them. We say to them, who's your favorite artist? You know, who are you into? What are you listening to?
Yeah.
Let's trace them back.
Yeah. Yeah, because first of all, it changes all the time.
From that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one comes from that one comes from this one, this is why they wrote that song, this is what was going on in society when that record came out, and bam, they are engaged, and they stay engaged, because kids do love to learn. You see, that's the fallacy. People think, oh, these kids don't want to learn. That's not true.
No, they're like sponges, man.
They want to learn something that they can use now.
Right.
You know, I call it teaching in the present tense, you know.
Yeah.
Don't tell kids, you can't tell kids like they told us, learn this now and someday you'll use it. That's not going to work anymore.
Well, you can learn more about Teach Rock, and there are over 200 lesson plans at teachrock.org. For more about Stevie, visit littlesteven.com. Stevievanzant.com. Stevie Van Zandt, thanks for joining us again, and be well, my friend.
Cool, Dave. Thanks. Same for you.
Thanks, Stevie. All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN. All right, our radio special, Legends of Rock, continues with Mick Jones of Foreigner.
Four decades later, it still feels like the first time for Mick Jones, who founded legendary rock group Foreigner back in 1977. They have five multi-platinum albums and another two multi-platinum compilations. They had nine Hot 100 top 10 hits, 80 million records sold, and the hits are endless. Jukebox Hero, Hot Blooded, Cold as Ice, Double Vision, I Want to Know What Love Is, barely scratches the surface. And oh, by the way, they belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And to talk about this journey is the legendary Mick Jones. Mick, welcome in, buddy.
Thank you, man. Good to be here.
You know, music. I want to talk a little bit about your upbringing and growing up in music. At a very early age, you started playing the guitar. Nero and the Gladiators was the first visible band you were part of. As a teen, you played the guitar on the same bill with the Beatles, opened for the Stones. Did you know pretty early on this is what you wanted to do, Mick?
Well, I guess by about the age of 13, let's say, I figured I just couldn't envisage me doing a day job kind of thing.
Yeah,
I knew I was an adventurer. I think born adventurer.
That's awesome. Okay,
that appealed to me a little more than the alternative.
Now, when you decided to form the band, what was the principal idea? Like, did you have a vision for exactly what you wanted it to be at the very start?
Well. Yeah, I mean, I did. I had spent a year. Well, I guess I was on Island Records for two or three years with Spooky Tooth, and that was definitely a part of my influence, you know. And I was, you know, I wanted it, if for lack of any other comparison, it would be, you know, cross between what Steve Winwood was doing, you know, what Bad Company were doing a bit, I guess. We had the same basic roots, you know, tastes in music. So it was just really a collection of my experiences and you know, I figured I could... you know, really try and give this a shot and see if it floated.
Yeah,
it rather quickly.
Yeah, and you know, it's fascinating to understand, you know, the origins and how something is built and put together. And just as the founding member of the band, I mean, you were searching obviously for vocalists, and because you've had some great experiences with some great vocalists over the years, you really had some very high expectations, like any talented musician would have if they were building a band, and you had in your mind a short list of candidates.
Yeah, we did, and I think I ended up probably around 40 singers we auditioned for that. It was obviously a crucial part for me anyway. It was, you know, I had to have a voice in my head that I could write for, you know.
Interesting, yeah.
And, you know, Lou and I worked very closely in those earlier years because he was, you know, he was still a bit of a rough diamond at that point. And I think I did some pretty good work with him.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know, it was getting a feeling going between us, a trust, and I gave all the experience I had, which was, you know, quite a lot by that time, and really spent a lot of time developing, you know, his phrasing and his just general approach to singing. We both knew that we were sort of within a certain area, very close. He loved, you know, English rock. I kind of liked American rock at the time. American R&B, actually, was one of my big influences.
But knowing you had two different perspectives on that sometimes can be a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes opposites attract, and there could be a nice blend between the two ideas, right? When you were writing Feels Like the First Time, you really had a song before the band, and you obviously thought Lou would be the ideal voice for this. So that was one of those situations where you just said, you know, I wanted to write for, find somebody that I could write for, but this was the opposite, where you had the song already and you had to find the right voice for the song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was, as corny as it sounds, it was the first song that I wrote and for, you know, for the band. And it was, I didn't really know quite what to do at that point, whether it was worth taking a shot at forming a band or just, I don't know, I wasn't fixed in my thinking yet at that point. Mm-hmm. I'd been in bands that had, you know, failed in a way just because of chemistry and
sure,
and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't, you know, I didn't really know whether I was ready to go through another, you know, experience like that. But so I chose younger, fresher people who had never really been in, you know, well-known bands or anything like that. I did enlist, however, Ian MacDonald, you know, who was founder of a band called King Crimson.
Sure.
And Dennis Elliott on drums, who was who I'd played a few sessions with. And I knew that he was the drummer pretty much immediately. And Carl Greenwood on keyboards was very inventive. And had some great sounds and great taste. And all together, it was, you know, a very cool lineup.
Yeah, three Brits, three Americans. The band was formed.
Right.
But here's the thing. Top hit right out of the box. And that obviously does not always happen. Were you surprised so quickly by the success? And did you know at that point, wow, we've really got something here? We're on our way?
Yeah, I mean, it did. It happened so fast, you know. There was kind of a hype, I think, built up about the band in a small way. And we were kind of, you know, we were making it up as we went along, really, and just trying to appear cool.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was earth-moving, you know.
We're talking to the legendary Mick Jones of Foreigner, and there's more when we come back on 720 WGN. Stay player on 720 WGN. We're talking to the legendary Mick Jones of Foreigner. It was a new era of radio play, record sales in the late 1970s. And, and when I look at the really what you accomplished, Mick, in those, in just in the first few years, first album, you know, Feels Like the First Time, Cold as Ice, then comes Double Vision, Hot Blooded, Double Vision. Next year, boom, another hit album, Head Games. You know, how did you keep yourself and the band grounded in all this? Because fame obviously can take a toll, and it has for so many bands.
Yeah. Well, luckily, there were no real big problems. I'd say, you know, we had fun. Yeah, we had to.
Yeah.
Just to take the pressure off sometimes.
Sure.
But there was, right from the very start, you know, we were setting precedents, and I just didn't know whether we could keep it up or not, you know, and I think a lot of people in the business were also thinking, where do they get off, you know, like selling 4 or 5 million on the first album,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And the first million seller that Atlantic Records had, you know, and they had the Stones, they had Zeppelin, you know, already. They had Yes, Genesis.
Sure, yeah.
And there we were, all of a sudden, topping everything.
Yeah.
And so that was a little surreal in a way, but it was great, exciting times.
Well, and it was your band. So, I mean, and it's always been your band, but over time, you know, there was competing thoughts on what the band should be, could be. You know, you come to a point where not everyone's on the same page, but when you're the guy that started it, I mean, you got to kind of put your foot down and lead.
Well, we had to do our growing up in the public eye, really. That was it. Once we had set those incredibly high standards, we had to bring it home every time after that. You know, and as I say, there were people that were hoping that we wouldn't, but somehow we managed to, you know, I dug very, very deep, and the results just started to get better and better. And, you know, it was pretty cool.
Many bands that had great success in the 70s had a difficult transition into the 80s. What do you think prepared Foreigner for that shift in music that made you a bit invincible at the time?
I think about that. I think it's obviously got something to do with the staying power of the song, really. The songs are all pretty recognizable from the first chord on. And I just feel that we made really good records, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, I'd had an experience in the studio, so I wasn't exactly green, you know, when we started out. So I put all the everything I'd learned into making it, you know, the best album I could possibly come up with.
Well, in Foreigner 4, iconic album, great, simple cover, urgent, the famous Junior Walker sax solo, Waiting for a Girl Like You, all the, was that album, you know, and I know, and I've seen you talk and read you talk about this before. Did you kind of say that album was really who you wanted to be?
Yeah, that was really closest to that I could think. It was a challenging album, but it was also a great experience working with Mutt Lange. He was very, very committed, and as with the whole band, you know, we knew we had, you know, if we were going to keep this going, we had to keep our nose to the grindstone, as it were.
Well, before I let you go, I have to also say, I think Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it's only a matter of time. There's no question in my mind and the mind of your fans.
Yeah, that's true. We just, I don't know, I don't like to dwell on it, but sometimes I think, wow, you know.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
But I'm not losing any sleep over it.
Okay.
We're doing very, very, very well without them.
You are.
At the moment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Dave Pryor, WGN. So women in rock radio, Patti Hayes, Terry Hemmert, Yvonne Daniels, Wendy Snyder. 23 years old, started at The Loop. Pretty cool, huh?
It's pretty cool that I am in that group. Because
yeah, well, of
I'm really like Patti Hayes, amazing.
Yeah.
Got to tell you, when I met Patti, she took me under her wing immediately.
That's cool.
And
cool.
Helped me. And she was the queen of rock and roll.
Yeah. Yeah. We got a chance. I got a chance to interview Elvis Costello. I literally asked, you know, and you know this, you don't always get who you ask for. And
almost never.
Almost never. And not only did he say yes, but he said, I'll come in studio. Which was crazy. So Elvis Costello in studio, and I remember you talking, I think it was back at The Loop, about your love for Elvis Costello.
I loved Elvis Costello. I named my cat Declan because Elvis's real name is Declan Patrick Aloysius McManus.
Yeah, right? Wow, yeah. See, that's why you were with me, yeah.
Yes. I think his birthday is August 27th.
Okay.
I might be mistaken.
Wow.
A little bit of a stalker.
Okay, yeah, just a little bit.
And I got to meet him a couple of times. Once he was nice to me, once he wasn't, but this was as a fan at a show.
Yeah.
And then, oh my God, you said, yeah, I'm going to interview Elvis Costello. Would you like to come in the studio? Like, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I thank you so much for
that
asking
was fun.
Me.
No, it was a lot of fun. And that's what we're going to share now. What is your favorite Elvis Costello song?
I kind of like Watching the Detectives.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's do that. All right. It's music legend Elvis Costello in studio along with Wendy Snyder. Some years ago, Elvis, you were on Stephen Colbert when they showed a clip of your father performing on television, a spitting image.
I am of him.
Exactly. The glasses, the shoes. And you talk about in the book, at such a young age, you know, you use some of his recording equipment as well. It's kind of a like father-like son thing, isn't it?
Well, I suppose it might appear that way. Certainly when my folks were together, my dad was in the front room learning songs that you know, I might have otherwise been told to turn down on my record player in my bedroom, you know?
Yeah.
I was 10 years old when I kind of started paying attention to the music that he was learning weekly. He sang with the Radio Dance Band, as you say. And that particular little clip was a short film that the orchestra he sang with made to commemorate the fact that they just played the very prestigious Royal Command performance alongside the Beatles that year. The Beatles were on it. It's the occasion where John Lennon famously said, well, you can clap along and the rest of you can rattle your jewellery. And that, of course, in those days, people didn't say that kind of cheeky stuff in front of the Queen Mother. So I had this exciting moment of watching my dad on the bill with my, you know, at the time, my favorite group.
That's pretty cool.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and
so.
The Beatles came back to kind of inspire you. A song that was playing that your dad was learning by the Beatles?
Well, yeah. I don't know what he did with all the records he brought home every night, every week, I should say. On this occasion, I was just moved to go in and ask him, what are you doing with that record when you finished with it? Could I have it? And it was Please Please Me, and the rest is misery.
And he was learning that for a performance.
Yeah, he would learn a big stack of records every week because that's the way music was heard in England. It was filtered through all the radio dance bands and palm court orchestras and the cinema organ. We didn't have hours and hours of pop radio. We just didn't. It was the way it was set up. It was because of the agreements with the Musicians' Union and the Performing Rights Societies. They were only allowed to play 5 hours of all the recorded music per day.
Wow.
Which meant that a lot of work for you know, working musicians, which was a good thing, kept us in beans and you know, brown ale, but it meant that the versions of the songs that we were familiar with first were often a bit bizarre. You know, they got used to it because that was what they were familiar with, but it was. I think there was a bit of tension between that and the groups of the day who also had to queue up to make guest appearances so their song could be heard. So they would come on these radio shows and play live. And that's how I got to see the Hollies up close when I was 10 years old.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
But I also got to see them set up. There was some magic to that transformation from a bunch of scruffy lads who walked in carrying their own amplifiers to a group that, and this was a lunchtime radio show, so they would have to somehow spruce themselves up and come out wearing their shiny suits. And
this is at a very young age. I mean, you're being influenced by all of this.
Yeah, about 10.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll stick around more with Elvis Costello and more of Wendy Snyder on 720 WGN.
Dave Plyer, Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN. We're talking to rock icon Elvis Costello. Saturday Night Live, you got banned from the show for years for changing the set list. Let's talk about that.
It's very much more talked about in America because people, including ourselves, didn't know what SNL was. That's one of the reasons that we perhaps ran into that problem there, because we were told the show was like Monty Python.
Yeah.
Because I suppose alternative to more mainstream comedy. That's all they meant by saying that. Bear in mind that we'd only been in the country 2 or 3 weeks, and every Saturday night we'd been working, so we'd had no opportunity to see the show. And the scrap that I was having was not so much with the show in any case. It was the record company wanting us to sing a specific song. Me thinking that song isn't really going to mean anything to people in America. I want to sing this then newly completed song, Radio Radio. And, hey, live was in the name of the show.
Right.
It seemed like a pretty good guess
that
we could do that.
Absolutely.
And the strange thing about it is that you have to remember there were no video recorders to speak of back then. So anybody that tells you they saw it after the fact is not telling the truth. They're remembering the little bit of reportage,
a little bit of a wise tale
at the time, and of course later it was repeated. And then once people started doing, you know, like when Sinead O'Connor tore up the picture of the Pope, somehow I got the blame. Ashley Simpson caught lip-syncing. Somehow I got the blame.
Yeah.
It's been nice of them to keep blaming me for that. But of course, I was back on NBC within 3 years.
I was going to say it was a short-term ban.
I didn't do SNL for 12 years, but maybe I wouldn't have been on it anyway. It's not your turn to be on every show. You know, it's like, I mean, all those shows are like a ride at the funfair. You have to get the back of the queue if you want to go on it again.
True.
And when you sat in for David Letterman, you were brilliant as an interviewer.
Thank you. I enjoyed doing that. I mean, David was, his producers were always very welcoming. I was on the show about 29 times as a music guest, maybe 30, I don't know, with all sorts of configurations. I played solo, I played with the Attractions, I played with the Imposters, I played with Burt Bacharach, and I played with some of my friends, you know, from other fields of music, the Fairfield Four, the Gospel Quartet, and myself, and the Jazz Passengers.
And I played with Paul, of course.
Yeah, and they let me play with all these people on the show. So when it came time to host, it was, you know, it was good fun to do that for one evening. I don't know that I would want to be doing that every night.
But you hosted your own show for a little while.
Different sort of form. You know, Spectacle was a show we did for Sundance Channel and CTV up in Canada, and it was conversation and music. So I was trusted by my victims to come in, and they share the stage willingly. But we share the similar job in the sense that we go onto the stage with words and music at our disposal and try to tell some sort of story. So whether it be Renee Fleming, the opera singer, or Lou Reed, very different sound of music, but still it's the same proposition. So there was always something in common, and it seemed to allow them to trust me. And we got to do I got to sing with some people that I never imagined I'd ever sing with, like Smokey Robinson.
Well, in depth to these conversations too. I saw a lot of them on YouTube. It was pretty cool.
Because it wasn't sound bites. We were able to talk it, you know, full sentences, and they were able to illustrate. People were very generous with their time. Bruce Springsteen did, I think we must have been in the Apollo Theater for 4 hours, you know, so a short night for Bruce.
Yeah.
That would be a short night for him. Now, you talk about the meaning behind some of your songs and not actually throwing it out there, but it's just part of the fabric of what you write. There's a chapter in the book called Unfaithful Music it's about the song Allison. Mm. You give away a little bit. You know, I believe that Allison was a work of fiction, taking the sad face of a beautiful girl glimpsed by chance and imagining her life unraveled before her. It was a premonition, my fear that I would not be faithful, or my disbelief in happy endings would lead me to kill the love that I had longed for. So you have said that the sad face of this beautiful girl was somebody you saw.
Somebody I glimpsed by chance, but it put in focus a feeling I had about myself. And it is a strange experience to write songs that other people see themselves in and know that it's something about yourself. I mean, I didn't advertise the nature of that song when it was first issued. This is something that I've come to accept was there, where I've mentioned it in the case of several songs. Some songs are sort of premonitions, maybe because you're writing them as songs, they dig out parts of your own psyche or your own nature or soul or whatever word you want to use to describe it. I've never really thought of it as that kind of divinity. But
do you know how many girls wish their name was Allison when you sang that?
I beg your pardon?
Do you know how many girls wish their name was Allison?
Well,
when
I think there's also probably just as many have been sick of people singing it to them because they know somebody annoying who heard it once. You know, I think there's actually both. And that's what I know to be true because people have told me. But no, of course, it's always... I would have written more songs of girls' names if I'd known how popular they were going to be.
In America, where the 1980s came around and music videos and MTV were out there, did you feel like that was really where you got a bigger splash and people got to really see you and see your performances?
Music videos are absurd. I mean, they there's a lot in the book about the absurdity of pop music. From very early on, when I was just in a semi-pro band, I described one night when I was lurking backstage between sets with my semi-pro band, and a reggae singer got up and lip-synced to his hit, which was from 5 years earlier and still upstaged. So, I mean, I got a glimpse then because he was well known, you know. Yeah. So people went crazy when they saw him. They didn't care whether he had the microphone stuck up the arm of his jacket when he tried to take his jacket off halfway through the song. People were just taken by the illusion of him singing. And make note of the fact that my voice was not heard on the BBC for the first 7 years or so of my career. Every single appearance on the BBC was lip-synced. So it was just some pictures of me in stupid clothes, you know. And on other channels, you know, obviously SNL, we were very much playing live.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were other opportunities to play music live. But I music videos in themselves were inherently ridiculous. They were, you know, they... The first ones were just us filled full of vodka and shoved in a room and jumping around.
And well, there's a lot of jumping going on.
A lot of jumping around, yeah. And then the later ones, you know, where we were making Casablanca or something, you know. Yeah. So there was some. They love to do those ones where the director would say, we've got this great idea. It's going to be like Ingmar Bergman. But it's a 5-minute pop song or 3-minute pop song. How can it be? You know, so.
The Veronica video was beautiful. Yeah. I really liked that.
Once in a while, Evan English, who I worked with on Veronica and I Want to Be Loved, those two videos had. They added something to the feeling of the song because he did something with the structure of the, you know, he had me singing along with the record in both of those, which created a different effect. And, you know, he framed it with images that actually echoed the meaning of the song. That was good. The more abstract ones were that you were just in some, you know, you're in a lifeboat and the lifeboat's on fire. I don't know what that is about. We never actually made that one. I just thought about it.
Sounds like a Monkees episode.
Yeah. Well, a few of them were like
that's
Monkees.
That's a comparison. That's a comparison.
We hired a villa in the south of France to do a bunch of them, and we took dancing lessons because we thought we were going to look like the Miracles. And this I don't know what had gone on in this villa, but the center of the living room had a Roman bath in it, so I didn't really want to think what kind of bacchanalia had gone on in there. So we filled it full of water and sort of fell into it fully clothed. Naturally, it was like a Monkees episode. Exactly, that's what they were. That's all they should have been.
What a funny comparison. Yeah. That's fabulous.
You know, each song you've ever penned, every single one of them has meaning, and you bring them alive in every performance, don't you?
There are songs which, if I play them, there's a chance that people know what they've meant to me, how I got to them in the first place. Not necessarily who is Alison? It's a bit of a
sure.
facile question.
Right.
But maybe some songs that are really deeply felt to me that are, you know, haven't been in the hit parade, but that doesn't make them lesser songs. If I can sing them and hold your attention and convince you in the moment, quite often the height, you know, the real moment in my shows is when a song that is not so well known is the one that really gets the attention. That's when you feel like you're doing something in the moment. That's something that records can't replicate. It's something that can't be stolen on a phone camera. It can't be downloaded. It has to happen in the company of other people because it's recognition of a moment which is unique and specific to that night, and next night it'll be different. Everything will happen in a different order. The emphasis will be in a different place. And the feeling for even the best known and the longest sung song in my repertoire will be different from night to night because of the way I go about it.
Which makes it fabulous.
It makes it more alive to me, and I hope for the audience, and that's why I'm not cheating them by coming out and singing something for cheap applause. I'm coming out and trying to get to the point of every song I sing. Do I get there every night? Who could?
Right,
you know,
exactly.
But I try my best to present myself with the challenge of working how all of this is connected. I've been lucky enough for these songs to come to me. I better work with them until I can't do it.
Well, all these stories, I mean, and we just touched the surface, are in Elvis's new book. It's called Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink, and you can pick that up at Amazon or wherever books are sold. And for more on anything Elvis Costello, visit elviscostello.com. Great having you in studio with One
Thank
Day and
you.
I tonight.
And,
Thank
and
you
also,
so much.
May I say, it's great if people go and get it delivered to their house. But go to your local bookshop.
Go to that
place where the people really think about books. Go to the shop that you love and buy the books that you love. I have a strong feeling. I think it's great that the big bookstores there have all the stock that they can afford to carry everything. But, you know, there's a bookstore everybody knows in one neighborhood or another where there are people who really have thought about the books they put on display, and I appreciate, you know, their care.
And supporting
the
local business.
In the same way as it's always been for me, the record shops were like that. That's how I learned the music that I learned. All I knew were just one or two songs that came out of America on compilation albums. I'd come and find
in the music stores.
Whole big sort of racks full of, whether they were, you know, brand new records or secondhand records or pawn shop records. Wherever you get it.
Sure.
You know. Yeah, but I appreciate that.
Thank you, Elvis.
Thank you very much.
All right, when can I do my interview with him?
right after this.
Are we doing it now?
720 WGN.
REO Speedwagon has been rocking across America for 55 years. Now, I will say my first concert and my first album I ever bought was REO's 7th studio album, You Can Tune a Piano, But You Can't Tune a Fish. And rock legend Kevin Cronin joins us on air right now. Kevin, how are you?
Dave, I'm fine. It's always a thrill for me to be on the air in Chicago, my hometown. And, you know, it's just, you know, you grow up, you know, being a little kid playing a guitar and listening to the radio and hearing your favorite records. And, you know, who would have ever thought that I'd be sitting here all these years later? And I'm on the air in Chicago. This is awesome.
Well, and WGN just turned 100 years old a couple of weeks ago. So, I mean, this has been a legendary station in this town for a very long time.
Yes, it has. My dad used to listen to WGN.
Yep.
I definitely part of the family.
Well, I have to ask you, my first album was yours. My first concert was REO. What was the first concert you ever attended and the first album you ever bought?
Well, the first album I ever got was the Beatles' Rubber Soul. Mm. And I didn't exactly buy it. I found it under the Christmas tree. Santa brought it for me on Christmas of 1964, if my memory serves. And the first concert that I ever went to was at the Auditorium Theater in Chicago, and it was Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And it was such an amazing show because it was their first concert.
Wow.
A lot of people think their first concert was the Woodstock Music Festival, but mm-hmm. their first show was at the Auditorium Theater in Chicago. They had Joni Mitchell on the bill, and Neil Young was their special guest, and it was... I was up in the cheap seats, and I did what I see people doing at our shows all the time. Between songs, when the lights went down, I beelined down the aisle and planted myself right in front of the stage and prayed that security wouldn't have me removed, and they didn't. And I watched the whole show up close and personal, and I've been a huge Crosby, Stills, and Nash fan ever since. And actually... the album that you mentioned, Building the Bridge, which will be the album that will be, we're actually re-releasing it, and that's the album that we're going to be selling at the concert this year with the proceeds going to Rock to the Rescue. There's a song on that record that I wrote with Stephen Stills, and, you know, he's been my musical hero, and to actually write a song with him that appeared first on a Crosby, Stills, and Nash album, and then REO did it for this album. So it's amazing all the rock and roll dreams of mine that have come true since those days with a transistor radio hidden under my pillow in Chicago growing up.
I love that. I love that. Well, how exciting it is, though, to be back on the road again. You got a full schedule this summer, and as we mentioned, Saturday, June 4th at the Hollywood Casino Amphitheater, back on tour again. This has got to be pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a big one, man. And, it's great to be back with our buddies Styx and Loverboy. You know, all three of our bands have known each other for a long time, get along great. You know, at this point in the game, I'm not interested in touring with any bands that are going to be, you know, all drama-filled. You know, with REO, Styx, and Loverboy, it's, you know, all the dressing room doors open, everybody, you know, bumping into each other, hanging backstage.
Yeah.
And you got to figure, when the bands are getting along on a personal level and the crews are working together to make the set changes seamless, the audience ultimately is the winner, because, you know, it's like anything else. If you're in a good mood, you're gonna do your job better. And it's going to be tough being away from home as much as I will be over this these next 4 months. But if you got to be away from home, you might as well be with your friends.
We're talking to Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. You know, you mentioned the Beatles being the first album you ever received. The Beatles on Sullivan is what made you really get serious about getting into rock and roll.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I started taking guitar lessons, you know, a couple of years before the Beatles came out. And I knew about Elvis, you know, but he was a little bit like, he was a half a generation before me, you know, so I didn't really feel the Elvis thing. But I was playing guitar, didn't really know why. And then the Beatles came on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I was like, "That now I know why I've been playing the guitar." And I feel so grateful that I was able to decide at that moment that that was what I wanted to do with my life, as did, you know, millions of other kids my age, you know, and I'm just very fortunate to have seen that rock and roll dream come true, and, you know, it's the fans that make it happen, and, you know, going out and playing, we'll probably play in front of 500,000 people over this summer,
wow.
To me, that's the payoff, you know, just playing our songs, and, you know, at this point, everybody in the audience pretty much knows them all, and they sing them along with us, and it's just a real communal atmosphere, and it's really the you know, other than sporting events are the same thing, where people are all there, and it's a communal thing, but when you go to a music concert, when you're singing along with the band, and you feel all the people in the audience singing along as well, that's a bond. That's just a special kind of moment that only happens at live rock and roll shows.
No question. And your songs are songs of a generation, and generations, I should say.
Yeah, I think so. And even if they don't know the lyrics, they sing along anyway. I mean, I know I'm that way. I think I know the lyrics to certain songs that are on, and then when I really think about it, I'm like, wait, these are just lyrics that I made up because I don't really understand what they're saying on the record.
Right.
But it doesn't matter because you're singing along and you know enough of the lyrics that it works. But I'll tell you, sometimes I'll be on stage and, you know, every once in a while, someone in the audience will catch my attention. So I'll kind of focus my singing on them for a second, on individuals that I can see from the stage. And sometimes someone will start out singing along, and then they get to the point where they really don't know what the lyrics are. And it's just it's an odd moment where I'm looking right at them, and they don't know the lyrics, and they know that I know that they don't know the lyrics. And it's just it's like, okay, I gotta find somebody else now, you know? Our relationship with the audience, it's a very special thing. And I was talking to my good friend, another Chicago boy, Richard Marks, yesterday. We were writing together and just talking about that special bond between, especially the singers. If you're the singer and you're singing your song to people, it's an unbelievable feeling. Yeah. And I'm just so grateful that I've been able to experience that and kind of share that vibe with the people that come to see us play. I really do love our audiences. I owe it all to them.
What exactly is an REO Speedwagon? That was a truck company, like a motor company in the early 20th century, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. The REO Speedwagon was a flatbed truck that it was actually originally a fire truck that could, you know, get to the fire quicker than a horse-drawn buggy. And it was kind of prophetic in a way because they were you know built to last, you know, they were kind of had a, you know, they kind of looked cool, you know, so the name kind of stuck with us. So
yeah, perfect.
Here we are, man.
There you are.
You know, matter of fact, the logo, you know, the famous wing logo that's on all of our t-shirts and everything, that was basically the hood ornament from the original Aria. And can you imagine now, they gave us, you know, they signed off on it, gave us permission. They never charged us anything to, you know, to use the name, to use the logo. Can you imagine?
Yeah, you'd be lawyered up today.
In this world today.
That'd be painful.
They welcome us. Every time we play Lansing, they bring an old Speedwagon out there.
And, wow.
You know, I've ridden around in them, so it's
very cool. Yeah, very cool. Kev, thanks so much for hanging out once again. I'll see you on tour and enjoy the journey this summer.
Thank you, David. Good talking to you, brother.
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. So Rock and Roll Hall of Famers Cheap Trick are responsible for many of rock's great anthems. Dream Police, I Want You to Want Me, Surrender, Southern Girls, The Flame, and countless others. For nearly 50 years, Rick Nielsen and Cheap Trick have been a force in the music industry. The Illinois-based Rockards put out their self-titled debut in 1977 and recently released their 20th album, a 13-track album called In Another World. The album features longtime vocalist Robin Zander, bassist Tom Peterson, as well as Nielsen's son Dax on the drums. It also includes a cover of John Lennon's Gimme Some Truth. And joining us to talk about his incredible journey in music is once again rock legend Rick Nielsen. What's going on, Rick?
How you doing, Dave?
I am outstanding. I want to jump in with this new album. We just opened this half hour with Another World, and like most of your albums, you know, there's never a conscious effort to build a new album. It all comes out of recording and playing together, and then boom, this album happens.
Yeah, well, it that's the way we do it.
Right?
One song at a time, and we like making albums as opposed to, you know, we making a single and then nine other tracks that aren't as good. When people have more patience, and it's not just all wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, rushing through things and, you know, thinking they hear the whole song if they hear the first 3 seconds of it. You know, it's like, I like albums that, like, when you get to the last track, you feel like starting over at the first track again.
Right. Well, that's always how you've done your albums. I mean, it's really just playing, writing one at a time. In fact, there's a bunch of songs that didn't even make it on this album, because once you guys get going, I mean, it just becomes nonstop.
Yeah, it's true. It's like we added 2 tracks that we didn't think we were going to do, and we actually did a slow version of one, and then when the producer went out of the room for 3 minutes, we did a fast version of it, and that made it to the record too. So it's like, you know, we love to record, we love writing songs, and love playing. So I was like, that's what we do.
Yeah.
I mean, if you wanted me to clean up your yard or something like that, I'm not very good at it.
Okay, fair enough. But hey,
my own yard either.
Well, I was going to say during the shutdowns and the pandemic, that's probably the only time in your life, in your career, that you were probably at home. You know, a lot of this time, and it was
I know, it's true. It's true. It's like, it was, I like being on the road.
Yeah.
You know, but I like being off too. I mean, it's just, I'm never bored anyhow. So it's like,
right.
I can entertain myself.
Sure. You used to write just about every song yourself, but now everyone kind of jumps in a little bit when it comes to new music, right?
Yes. And it was, everybody has ideas. And it's like, you know, I used to write it all, and I used to do it all, and it was like, that's all right, but it's like, you know, it's like, you know, I don't like to compare myself to it, but like the Beatles, you know, it's like, did George have some, you know, it's like, he didn't come out until the Beatles were basically done,
right,
before we knew that he was, you know, what he could do, and it's tough. I mean, you've got main writers who, Aerosmith and Rolling Stones. I mean, so, hey, what did this guy in the Stones do? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all Nankerfeld or, you know, Richards Jagger. You know, it's like, and so it was like, yeah, let's do it. You know, it's like, it's easier to keep songs that aren't of the caliber that we think we would like off a record if we share it.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, no, I like that. I like that thought process. No, I know a favorite technique of yours in songwriting that is just obvious in so much of what you've written is using double and triple entendres. You know, Surrender might be a the perfect example of all that.
Yeah, well, and the lyrics in that song too. It's like you know, it's half true and half part of my life.
Right.
So it's like, and that's, is that true or what? You know, it's like, you know, the characters in the thing were, I mentioned about mommy was a whack in the Philippines. Well, my mother wasn't, but my aunt was.
Gotcha.
And why do you need to go through and try to explain? It's hard enough to explain anyhow.
Right.
And so it's like, you just leave it as is. And Indonesian junk. You know, what does that mean?
Right.
That mean the ship, or does that mean heroin, or does that mean,
right,
you know, what? Or,
makes you
or
think.
Just sounds good. Yeah, or is it because there's a band in Milwaukee called Indonesian Junk? You know?
I like it. Well, I mean, then from there, I mean, though, that, you know, you and Tom got your first record deal in the 60s, the Grim Reapers, then,
yeah,
Fuse. And I love that we were on
McClurg Court.
CBS. I know that. The old barn.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Yeah. I didn't know there was a recording studio in there.
Yeah. We were there on McClurg Court, and we recorded with Jackie Mills,
wow,
the producer. And, our first record came out and didn't go very far.
No, but I mean, you know, and it was a few years later, it was 77 that, you know, you guys were playing as Cheap Trick, you know, 250, you know, one nighters a year, opening for Kiss, The Kinks, Santana, Boston. And, you know, then you guys finally put out that first album. Did that first album, when it came out, is that when you felt like you guys were something and you were on your way, or was it really the next album? What was it for you?
Well, I think we always felt like we were on our way. You know, it's, yeah, like we didn't know where, and it's like, you know, we felt good about ourselves. If somebody gave us a bad review or didn't like our band, we thought that was cool.
Yeah.
because we're musicians. We're supposed to be poor. And we're supposed to have no success.
Yeah.
And it's like, but we believed in ourselves. And so, you know, we used to get fired. We didn't get fired a lot, but we got fired a few times because we lied just to get the job. We said, yeah, that, you know, yeah, we play all top 40, and then we go in there and play. We didn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like one place I remember we got fired in Lake Geneva after the first night. And they said, you know, we wanted to hear top 40. You were playing all this other junk. So we took that as a badge of courage.
Yeah.
Later we were, later we were the house band at a place called the Black Knight. We played there all the time, you know, five sets a night,
wow,
7 days a week. And, you know, it's like, we always thought we were good. You know, it's like, so telling Rick, you're ugly and you're not talented. Yeah,
yeah,
okay. Yeah, yeah, so what?
Yeah, gotcha.
I didn't take it. That's not a bad. That was nothing bad.
Yeah. No, not at all. Not at all. But, you know.
Still isn't.
No, but you know what's funny is you guys, you know, you put on Color and Heaven Tonight. You know, and that kind of gave you that international acclaim, but not quite in the U.S. It was the Japanese press that really, like, threw you out there. Like, seriously. When you did, you know, that live album, it was one of the greatest live albums of all time.
Well, you know, you mentioned some of the bands that we opened for. Well, in 1977, before our first album came out, we did the two opening shows on the Queen tour. And it was in Milwaukee and it was in Madison. And Thin Lizzy was supposed to be there. But they, you know, they were late, or I don't know what the deal was. I was happy we got it. The Japanese press were there to see Queen, you know, because they were huge in Japan. And we played, and they happened to like us, which is odd, you know, for an opening band, you know, playing for the headliners. But they liked us so much where they asked if I would write an article. What's it like touring with Queen? You know, it's like, well,
oh, that's cool.
I didn't really know, but... Okay, I'm crazy enough to do it. And so we did it. And soon after that, we started getting fan mail. And in the Japanese magazines, there'd be caricatures of ourselves. We're getting fan mail from people we didn't know.
Wow.
And the record, two songs became hits in Japan. Clock Strikes 10 was number one, which that was from our second album. And, you know, and then right after that, then we toured with Kiss, and the same thing. The press was there from Japan to see Kiss, but they liked us. And then we got more fan mail before you know it. Now, that was 77. So then we had those couple of hits, and then now we get asked to go to Japan in 78. And we sold all these shows out, you know, two shows at Budokan.
Sure.
And it's like we thought they were the smartest people on earth.
Because, yeah.
Yeah. You know, they liked us, and... And we were doing well.
Yeah.
And it was the same belief we had in ourselves, you know, playing at the Black Knight. in Lake Geneva or wherever we played, or at the Night Gallery in Waukegan. I mean, we played there. We'd play the graveyard shift there too.
But I like what you're saying. Like, you all, you know, it wasn't something that, you know, gave you the confidence. You and the band always had confidence in yourself. There was just certain points in time that, you know, whether, you know, it was an album that came out or a concert or whatnot that just threw you into larger critical fame, but you always had that confidence.
Yeah, we did. You know, it's like, you know, we know it's not, you know, a lot of people have confidence, you know, but, you know, and a lot of to do with luck too, but, you know, we always felt that we were treated, I treat people better than they deserve. And I thought we were always treated not like we deserve, but I always felt like we were something, even if we're playing for nobody in the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Think of all the people that are missing this.
Yeah, right. Think about that. Absolutely. We're talking to rock legend Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN. Stay player on 720 WGN. We're talking to rock legend Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick. Their new album is called In Another World. You have paired up and toured. We were talking about some of the bands with so many other rock legends. What are some of the standouts that you really enjoyed, you know, touring with?
Well, we did a lot of shows when we were both about the same level of a draw. We with AC/DC,
mm-hmm.
and they were great. They were great, and we loved playing with them. So one night they'd be headlining, next night we'd be headlining. And we just got along well. I mean, when we did a show a bit later, we played the 4th of July with Steve Dahl and Teenage Radiation,
oh, yeah. mm-hmm.
AC/DC and the Babies, I think it was. And we played, we had 40,000 people.
Wow.
At Pecatonica Fairgrounds, it was. It's outside of Rockford. And the day before, I had just purchased a house. I hadn't even moved in. I was still living in an apartment in Rockford. And I took Angus and Malcolm and Cliff
wow.
came to my house. And then we took them over to my new place and drove around. You showed them, you know, like, okay, look at the house. But we got along well enough where it was kind of cool.
You just hung out, yeah.
And then I actually took Bon Scott to a Mexican restaurant. He'd never had Mexican food before. And then fast forward to the last tour that Malcolm did before he quit and then before he died. I went to Nashville and with a friend of mine, and we flew down there for the last show of the tour. And there was they weren't letting anybody, all, you know, all the locals or country celebs that wanted to see AC/DC and all this stuff. They weren't letting anybody in. They let me in, and I was the only one to walk in the dressing room and says, "Hey, Rick, you still living in Rockford?"
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Like, you know, it was just like, we hadn't missed a beat, you know.
Well, the new album is In Another World, available now. And for more on Cheap Trick and upcoming concerts, tours, hopefully soon, easy enough, it's cheaptrick.com. Rick, always a pleasure hanging out and chatting with you. And I really do hope to see you live and in person soon.
I hope so too, Dave.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
All right, that wraps up our radio special, Legends of Rock. Have a great weekend, everybody.